Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
And you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker, and today for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. Our guest today is James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. James, welcome to Think.
Delighted to be here. Thank you, Stephen.
Anytime. Thanks for being here. If there's one theme that continued to jump out to me while reading the book, it was that Sinatra could be this like really loving person one day and then just the meanest person the next. Were you able to come up with any explanation as to why he acted that way?
He gave. He got as he gave. He gave as he got. He gave the world what had been given to him. He was brought up by a mother, and his mother really was his primary parent. His father was very much in the background of his upbringing. Dolly Sinatra was a tough mother. Sinatra said in later years that he never knew whether Dolly was going to hug him or hit him, and in fact, she did hit him. She and Frank's father ran a tavern in Hoboken, New Jersey. They kept a sort of a policeman's baton behind the bar in case there was trouble, and when Frank got out of line, Dolly used to whack him with it.
And it sounded like his tough relationship with Dolly really started from birth. He had a very difficult childbirth.
He was 13 and a half pounds when he was born. He was yanked out of his mother with forceps, which scarred the left side of his face grievously. His jaw, his ear was badly damaged. And I think that both mother and son were traumatized by the birth. Frank was an only child. I think Dolly Sinatra decided she didn't want to have to go through that again.
You write in the book that Sinatra's heart had many chambers. What did you mean by that?
He was an exceedingly complex man. He was, and he was really many men. He was a genius. He was an exquisitely sensitive man. He was capable of deep love and of real passion. At the same time, the overarching passion in his life was always for his singing career. And so when it came to his singing career, any intimate was really expendable. Any friend, any lover, any wife, his singing and his career always came first. He was... As an Italian-American growing up in the 1920s and 1930s, he was part of a minority, a social group that was very low down on the scale in America in those days. And he had enormous feeling, sympathy for other minorities. He was a passionate liberal early in his life and a great proponent of tolerance. He listened to the great jazz musicians of the day on 52nd Street in Manhattan and quickly saw that anti-black prejudice was folly, because these mostly black jazz musicians were geniuses, and he was very aware of this. And so really all his life was fiery in his opposition to racism and to intolerance. At the same and was a very charitable man. At the same time, he had a gigantic ego, a volcanic temper. He could be brutal.
You mentioned some of his early influences. One of those influences was definitely Bing Crosby. What kind of influence do you think that he had on Frank's career?
Well, Sinatra was an only child, as I said, and his mother was an ambitious woman who made sure that the family was well taken care of. She was a midwife, she was an abortionist, and she took the family from a tenement to nicer and nicer apartments, and finally to a beautiful townhouse. Frank had his own bedroom. He was an only child in the Depression, a great rarity. He had his own bedroom, his own cathedral model radio, and quickly became fascinated with that radio and the voices coming through, and particularly with the singers of the day. And Bing Crosby was a revelation to Frank Sinatra. Bing Crosby was a great singer in the midst of many affected sounding singers of the time of the 1930s. Crosby was direct. He was warm. He sounded like a real man singing. He sang beautifully. He was a great jazz singer. He had a hipness about him, a sense of humor. Frank idolized him from the beginning and even imitated him, tried to imitate the way Crosby sang and even imitated the way Crosby dressed, his yachting cap, the pipe he stuck in his mouth. Frank, at the beginning, was sort of like a mini Bing.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. He, like you said, he walked around wearing that yachting cap all the time, and it kind of just, I felt like it showed, I don't know, something in Frank's personality that he was going to always feel like he wanted to stand out from the pack.
He did. He knew, he said in later years that when he was 9 years old, he heard the music of the Spheres. And yet there he was in Depression era Hoboken, a very tough blue-collar town. He wasn't about to let on to his pals that he was hearing the music of the Spheres. So he affected a certain toughness himself, and yet he was a brilliant man. He knew he was possessed of a certain kind of genius. I think that it's very often the case. You know, you may have heard it said of William Faulkner that went in his hometown of Oxford, Mississippi, he used to be called Count No Count because he had all these affectations. You know, he walked around like he was somebody. And Sinatra was very much the same. And I think in each case, you had somebody who had an enormously complicated inner world, inner life, and really knew in each case that he was possessed of some kind of genius.
Now, Sinatra's first big break came when he joined Tommy Dorsey's band. How do you think Dorsey shaped him?
Well, Dorsey was an enormous influence. We shouldn't neglect it. It's more than a hiccup, really. There was about 6 months before that when he sang with Harry James, Texas's own Harry James, who was a great trumpeter, a great band leader, unfortunately very bad with money and couldn't keep the band together. Sinatra got hired by Tommy Dorsey, who was the greatest band leader of the day, and Sinatra had a weak father, and as a young man was constantly looking for father figures. Dorsey was the most powerful father figure that Frank encountered as a young man. Dorsey was a brilliant musician, a great trombonist, a great band leader, a great businessman. He was a regal presence, beautifully dressed at all times. He was also a fiery personality, hot-tempered, fearless physically. He would fist fight anybody who got in his way. It didn't matter how big they were. Sinatra took one look at Tommy Dorsey and thought, this is the man I want to be.
And when Sinatra ultimately left Tommy Dorsey's band, it was sort of unprecedented for a singer to strike out on his own during those days, was it?
It's hard for us to remember this, really, but in the days of the big bands from about 1935 to 1945, the singer on the band, whether it was a boy singer or a girl singer, that's what they used to call them, was really secondary. The band leader, Tommy Dorsey, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, those guys were the stars. They would play their instrumental. Tommy Dorsey would play a beautiful long intro on his trombone, and then the singer would come on and sing for a minute, and then Tommy Dorsey would play the outro. You know, he'd play out the song. The singer was secondary, but as Sinatra began singing with Dorsey, an incredible thing happened. Suddenly, only about 6 months into his tenure with Dorsey, the teenage girls began to crowd to the front of the room, up to the edge of the bandstand, and they began to scream for Frank Sinatra. And very quickly, Frank Sinatra, the cart was in front of the horse all at once. Frank Sinatra became the star of that band. Tommy Dorsey was flabbergasted, but he, being the great businessman he was, he knew how to take advantage of it, and he began featuring Sinatra at the top of the bill. But in those days, singers were secondary until Frank Sinatra changed things.
And it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting you remember that. You mentioned that, too, because it was around this time, like shortly after he left, I believe, that he hired a publicist named George Evans. It also kind of tapped into that Bobby Soxer's craze a little bit.
There had never been a phenomenon like this. You know, we use the word, we throw around the word superstar today. In those days, that vulgar word didn't exist. But in 1943, when Sinatra left Tommy Dorsey, and by the way, Tommy Dorsey was furious and sued Sinatra, and there were all kinds of legal repercussions. But Sinatra got out on his own and hired George Evans, the top publicist of his day. Evans took a look at the Screaming Girls, took a listen at these Screaming Girls, and thought, here is something that I can really put to good use. Evans felt that it was a wonderful, a powerful phenomenon, but a little bit out of control, and so he set about controlling it. He would hire girls, 20, 30 girls in any given venue, give them each a crisp $5 bill, which in those days was real money, and coach them exactly when to scream, not in the soft emotional passages of the song, but when the band was playing a little louder. And it was like seeding the clouds, you know. When the girls started screaming, the ones who had been coached, all the other girls began screaming too, and pretty soon you had, in this venue, you had pandemonium.
And it was also around this time when he first met Ava Gardner. He was already married to Nancy, but he met Ava Gardner when he went to Hollywood. And I wanted to read a little passage from your book where you describe their initial meeting. You write that all he knew as he shook her hand that morning for just a second too long was that he wanted to possess her. It was a familiar enough feeling, and he was confident as ever that he would. But as she released his hand, she gave him another look, slightly inquisitive this time, and something in his gut revolved a little bit. It was just the flicker of a sensation, and it confused him momentarily. He took a sip from his cardboard cup and smiled at her over the rim, and then she turned and walked down the studio street. Now, I'm very curious, as a biographer, how do you go about piecing together a scene like that?
Yes, I've been taken to task a little bit piecing a little bit too much. You know, this is a lyrical book about a lyrical subject, and I do want to emphasize that I did an enormous amount of research for this book. There are scenes that feel like maybe like scenes in a movie or scenes in a novel, but in every case, I studied the facts that were there, the whereabouts of the characters of Frank and Ava at that time. I would even look up the weather on a day when they were together to get an idea of what it felt like at that given moment. And so there are details that that feel as though they may have been invented, but in fact most of them were details that really happened.
We're talking today with James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from James after a short break and a little Frank Sinatra right here.
Day in, day out, the same old hoodoo follows me about, the same old pounding in my heart whenever I think of you. And darling, I think of you day in and day out. Day out.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker, and today for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. And my guest today is James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about Sinatra's approach to music. He had a very specific way that he would go about interpreting a song, and I wonder if you could walk us through that process.
Well, one of the big surprises, Stephen, to me of doing this book was how incredibly hard Frank Sinatra worked on his singing. He makes it sound effortless. It was not. He was a diligent student of singing, of diction, of breath control. He studied the lyric of a song very, very carefully before he ever sang a note of the song. He really moved into that lyric. He lived there before he sang it, and the result is that we feel it.
And I'm curious, do you think that he had a good sense of what would be a hit?
I think that he had a good sense of a song that he could relate to, but he could be hit and miss, not to pun, about the songs that he picked. You know, singing hits was always paramount to him, and he had people who helped him to find songs, but there were, throughout his career, there were a number of not-so-great songs that he'd elected to sing, thinking that they would be hits, and in fact, some of them did turn out to be hits, and then some great songs, surprising number of great songs that Frank Sinatra never sang.
We're talking today with James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. Now, one of Sinatra's earliest recordings is a song called All or Nothing at All. And I thought it was interesting you write that song actually had kind of a different structure than a lot of songs at that time.
It was a song. He first recorded it with Harry James in 1939. And in those days, the usual structure for a band song was that you had a long intro played by the lead instrumentalist, and then there would be a comparatively brief vocal, maybe about a minute, of singing by the boy singer or girl singer, that's what they called them in those days, on the band, and then the lead instrumentalist, Tommy Dorsey, Harry James, whoever it was, would play out the song. All or Nothing at All is a vocal that begins at the beginning, extends all the way through the song. It's all vocal. It's a very strong song, and I believe it's one that holds up.
And we've got a little bit of that we can listen to now.
I said all, nothing at all. If it's love, there ain't no in between. Why begin and cry for something that might have been? No, I'd rather have nothing at all.
Now, Sinatra recorded that song when he was 23 and continued to sing it virtually his entire career. Why do you think it stuck with him for so long?
Well, it is, and by the way, I should add that what we were just hearing there was the wonderful Nelson Riddle arrangement of All or Nothing at All, the up-tempo
right.
arrangement that Frank did in the mid-1950s. It was a song that was a touchstone for him. He first recorded it with Harry James in 1939. When it was released in 1939, that record sold 8,000 copies. It didn't do much. Harry James was not a great businessman, and he wasn't really selling records in those days. When Sinatra went out on his own in 1943 and signed with Columbia Records, Columbia Records re-released All or Nothing at All and sold a million of them.
Wow.
So it was a powerful song for Sinatra, first because it was a terrific song, second because it was the first song that he recorded that meant something to him with Harry James, and then third, because it had become such a big hit. It really was a touchstone.
Now, one of the songs that you write in the book that you say really showed Sinatra at the top of his game is a song he recorded in 1951 called I'm a Fool to Want You. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I'm a fool to want you, to want a love that can't be true, a love that's there for others too. I'm a fool to hold you.
Now, why does that song stand out to you?
Sinatra recorded that song at a very tough time in his life. His career was on the downswing. He had been dropped by his movie studio. His records were no longer selling. He was soon to be dropped by his agents as well, and even by his record label, Columbia. His career was really going nowhere, and more importantly, his passionate love affair with Ava Gardner, and they had married in late 1951, was on the way out. Ava Gardner was beginning to tire of him. She was supporting him for one thing, which didn't do wonders for the relationship, and was beginning to become involved with other men. And in particular, there were a couple of romances, on-set romances, while she was shooting films in Europe with a bullfighter or two. Sinatra was losing her when he recorded this song, and you can hear it in the song. It's an amazingly emotional rendition. You know, Sinatra was renowned as a singer who would do as many takes of a song as it took to get it right, sometimes over 20. He recorded I'm a Fool to Want You in one take, and when it was done, he ran out of the studio in tears.
And it's interesting you mentioned the how that song related to his time with Ava Gardner, because I don't think Sinatra was probably a guy who was used to being left by somebody.
Well, Ava Gardner was very different, and she was perhaps the unique example in his life of a woman who was every bit as powerful as he himself was. They were very similar, the two of them. They both loved to drink. They loved sex. They hated sleep. They stayed up all night. They were passionate. They were volcanic. They had fiery tempers. They pushed all each other's buttons in good and bad ways. They had amazing furniture-smashing fights and then incredible makeup. She was very much a match for him, and he would never really encountered it before, and would never really encounter it again in his life.
You mentioned that she was sort of carrying him financially during those days. Do you think that was the main reason for their split, or was it just all of this volcanic activity together?
I think there were a lot of reasons. I think that it had to, you know, it's a terrible rule of thumb, but there is a rule of thumb out there that passionate, I forget who said it. There was some famous woman who said that passionate love affairs have a life of about 3 years. And 3 years was about what they had together. Their passion was waning. The buttons they pushed with each other were becoming overwhelming. But the fact that Sinatra's career was going down, and that he became ever needier emotionally and even financially, didn't sit well with Ava Gardner. She didn't find it attractive. She was a tough, tough lady, and she took no prisoners, and Sinatra did not endear himself to her when he became weaker and more vulnerable.
You mentioned earlier the arranger Nelson Riddle, who Sinatra started working with in the fairly early 50s. And another milestone song for Sinatra was I've Got the World on a String, which was arranged by Riddle. What was that relationship like?
Well, Riddle was similar to Sinatra also in many ways. Not fiery exactly, but he was another musical genius from New Jersey, and he was another moody temperament. Both Frank and Nelson Riddle were deeply moody guys, and they were musical geniuses. They were really simpatico musically, Riddle and Sinatra. They didn't know it when they first met. Sinatra had never heard of Nelson Riddle, but Riddle was a genius arranger who was able to bring so many strains to his composing. He was a great fan of classical music, of the Impressionist composers. He was able to bring all of that to his arranging, and Sinatra's ears were really expanding. His musical sensibility was really increasing as he aged, and Riddle really educated him.
And we've got I've Got the World on a String, and let's listen to a little bit of that now.
What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go.
I'm curious why, I know why, but I'm curious why arrangers were so important in those days to singers like Sinatra.
Well, it is harder for us to understand in these days of computers and synthesizers and drum machines and rock and roll, when everything has become much more mechanized, when often our favorite singers go out on stage with just a guitar or a piano behind them. In those days, records and singers, popular singers, were usually backed by orchestras. And the sound of the orchestra was absolutely integral and essential to the sound of the singer. The arrangement was crucial, and for the arrangement to be constructed so that the singer was highlighted, was augmented, was featured, and in a loving and artistic way, was a great art. And a very complex art, and it was really geniuses at the art who brought out great singers like Sinatra.
So we listened to, I know it was a later arrangement, but we listened to a song from early in Sinatra's career, and then that last song was sort of mid-career. I'm curious how you feel like his style changed from those early days to maybe the early 50s.
His voice changed, for one thing. You can hear it changing when you listen to Sinatra, when you listen to the great Sinatra recordings of the early to mid-1940s on Columbia Records. It's a higher voice. It's a more youthful and yearning voice, more romantic. He is like the romantic young Swain. When he goes through his terrible career downturn, and he had some voice problems in the late 40s and early 50s, he had some emotional problems. He grew up. He was becoming. He reached middle age. He reached the age of 40 in 1955. But he was approaching middle age, and his voice deepened. It became more oaken. It became more like. It became more of a baritone, whereas before it had been closer to a tenor.
Yeah, and it seems like as you say. By the time he's close to 40, I mean, he's lived a lot of those songs that maybe he didn't quite have the personal experience with when he was in his early 20s.
personal experience was a big part of his greatest performances, and one striking example of that is the wonderful and towering Rodgers and Hammerstein soliloquy from Carousel, which Sinatra recorded a number of times, but really, to my mind, only brought home, and this is going to be amazing sounding, but his greatest rendition of soliloquy, which is all about fatherhood, Sinatra performed in his 80th year.
Wow. Because it's, you know, he, let's just say, wasn't around much as a father when his kids were young anyway. So it's interesting that that would become, you know, one of his signatures.
Well, it didn't become a signature until very late in life and until he had been through a good deal of agony as far as guilty agony as far as his family was concerned.
I'm curious, as you were researching the book, you know, like you had said, you you read, you know, a lot of books, including obviously Ava Gardner's memoirs and Nancy Frank's daughter's book about her father. And I'm curious, as you were reading those books and researching the book, researching your book, did you ever feel like the people that were writing about him weren't necessarily telling the whole truth?
Oh, I constantly felt that. You know, writers. And particularly writers who are writing memoirs always have an axe to grind. However, I would say a great exception to that rule is Tina Sinatra's memoir of her father called My Father's Daughter, which is a wonderful book and pretty blunt in a lot of ways about her father's vulnerabilities and shortcomings.
We're speaking today with James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from James after a short break.
Stately clock as it stands against the wall, like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops. When the summer shower is through, so a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
The winner is Frank Sinatra.
That's a clever opening.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I'm deeply thrilled and very moved, and I really, really don't know what to say because this is a whole new kind of thing, you know, song and dance man type stuff. And I'm terribly pleased, and if I start thanking everybody, I'll do a one-reeler up here, so I better not. And I'd just like to say, however, that they're doing a lot of songs here tonight, but nobody asked me. But I love you, though. Thank you very much. I'm absolutely thrilled. Thank you.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker, and today for Chris Boyd, who's on vacation. Our guest today is James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice, and that was Mercedes McCambridge announcing Frank Sinatra as the winner of Best Supporting Actor in 1954 for his role in From Here to Eternity. Now, Sinatra wanted to be in From Here to Eternity very badly. What got him so obsessed with playing that part?
Well, Sinatra was at a very tough point in his life and in his career. As I said, a terrible career downturn in the late 1940s and 1950s. He picked up this novel, From Here to Eternity, when it came out in early 1951. The book was an immediate sensation. Of course, it was a great novel of the U.S. Army shortly before World War II began. In Hawaii, which is where World War II began, and for the United States. And in the book, there was a character named Angelo Maggio, who was a private, army private from Brooklyn. He was a tough little Italian-American with a chip on his shoulder, very streetwise, and really sort of one of the world's losers, a guy who was sort of always under the heel of authority. Sinatra really identified with Maggio. And Frank, in his movie career to that point, had been mostly doing singing and dancing roles, often for MGM, in a sailor suit. He wasn't really looked on as a serious actor. This was a very serious point in his life. And as soon as that book came out, it got optioned by Columbia Pictures, which began to put together a movie project to be based on From Here to Eternity. Sinatra badly wanted to play Angelo Maggio in the movie of From Here to Eternity, but nobody took him seriously.
Yeah, I'm curious. You know, you led me right into my next question, which is, how did a guy who was not known as an actor and really kind of a has-been at this point get such a plum role like that?
Well, it wasn't easy, but I will tell you there was no horse's head involved, Stephen.
I'm sure somebody was wondering that.
Okay, yeah. The Godfather was a terrific movie, a great movie, and a terrific novel. And it's a work of fiction, and the horse's head was part of that fiction. Frank Sinatra was not Johnny Fontaine, and he got that role through a lot of hard work on his part and a little bit of luck. Also a lot of hard work on Ava Gardner's part. You know, as soon as that book came out, virtually, as soon as it got optioned by Columbia Pictures, Sinatra began barraging Columbia Pictures with telegrams, signing every one of the telegrams Maggio. He would sign the telegrams with the name of that character. And almost at the same time, Ava Gardner, who, as I said, was beginning to get tired of Frank Sinatra, nevertheless, she still loved him. She went to Harry Cohn, who was the head of Columbia Pictures, and said that she would give Columbia Pictures a free movie if they would screen test Frank Sinatra for the role. Well, Harry Cohn, head of Columbia Pictures, was also a noted Lothario, and he took one look at Ava Gardner, the gorgeous, gorgeous Ava Gardner, and he thought, well, what else might he get for free? So he gave Frank Sinatra a screen test, and Sinatra nailed the screen test.
And he was pretty much up against Eli Wallach for that role, is that right?
Yes. Eli Wallach also did a great screen test for the role, but there were a couple of things. One, Eli Wallach was a big, strong, muscular guy, and he didn't look like the skinny little Angelo Maggio. Another thing was that Eli Wallach's agents wanted a lot of money for him to do that role. He was an established stage actor. He was a big name. Sinatra was down on his luck, and he said that, Frank did, that he would do that role for next to nothing, just for expenses. So between the screen test that he nailed and the fact that he would do the role for almost nothing, he got the job.
Let's go to a call. Now we've got Ken in Plano, who has a question about Sinatra's changing musical style. Ken, you're on.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could, Sinatra started his career as sort of a crooner. And, you know, if I looked into this, there's a million of those around at that time. That sort of Russ Colombo, Bing Crosby style. And he became immortal when he became, it seems to me, a jazz singer. He sort of took on the stylings of Ella Fitzgerald or Louis Armstrong. Talk about those influences and why his singing has become so memorable. Thank you.
Sure. I would say that Sinatra, I would differ with you a little bit on that. I would say Sinatra always sounded like Sinatra. He was more of a crooner early on, but I associate crooners with the higher voices, a less masculine sound, if you will. You know, Sinatra always idolized great jazz artists from the beginning of even before his career began. Sinatra was going to 52nd Street and hearing these tremendous jazz instrumentalists and singers. He was crazy about Billie Holiday. He loved Lester Young. He loved Louis Armstrong. So jazz was very important to him, and you can hear Sinatra singing with the Metronome All-Stars, among them Johnny Hodges and Buddy Rich and Nat King Cole. 1946, much earlier than you would expect. Yeah, Sinatra did an amazing, amazing rendition of Sweet Lorraine, which was really pure jazz. And so I think jazz was always at the back of his mind. Perhaps it came more to the forefront as he hooked up with Nelson Riddle and the arrangers that could provide him with more upbeat orchestrations.
And now let's go to Ted in Dallas, whose ears were obviously perked up when you mentioned the horse head, and he's curious about Sinatra's involvement in the mafia. Ted, you're on.
Yeah, that's basically my question. I had wondered about that because there have been intimations over the years. I'm a musician, so I've been in the business for a long time, and I've heard things like that.
Well, I think Sinatra had an infatuation with the mafia. Don't forget that he was an Italian American at a time when Italian Americans were very far down in the social scale in the United States. In fact, Italian Americans were not, shameful as it is to recall, were not even legally considered white at a time when whiteness was very much prized. So Sinatra saw these guys in the mob, most of whom, or many of whom, were Italian-American. He saw them as men of power, men, he thought, of honor. He idolized them much as a small boy idolizes cowboys. He thought they were tough guys. And we should also not forget that in those days, it is easy to forget how powerful a force nightclubs were in American culture. They don't really exist that much anymore. People went out in those days. They went to clubs, and the clubs were run by the mob. So every entertainer who played a nightclub came in contact with the mob. Sinatra was no exception, but Sinatra, unfortunately, developed a kind of infatuation with these guys, and that was a relationship that lasted for much of the rest of his life.
We're talking today with James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing us at think@kera.org. Now, I found it interesting that after Frank's breakup with Ava, it seemed like he was comforted by his first wife, Nancy. What was their relationship like?
They really loved each other, and they respected each other. Sinatra could never be a good husband to Nancy Sinatra. Frank could never be a good husband to her. Not even from the beginning of their marriage in 1939. The women were coming at him from the start of his career in the late 1930s. He gratefully and happily accepted every one of them, turned very few away, and there were hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of them. And I think Nancy Sinatra at the beginning thought that it was okay, or at least she could live with it as long as he came home to her, but soon the infidelities just became too blatant. And by the time Ava Gardner came along, Nancy Sinatra had had enough. She changed the locks on the house, and Frank was out. At the same time, he always returned to her for solace. They had a unique sort of relationship that lasted for the rest of his life. They remained very close friends, and perhaps even more than that. And it was just, it no longer remained a marriage, but always a very, very deep and emotional kinship between the two of them.
Could you talk a little bit about your decision to end the book in 1954 after Sinatra wins the Oscar?
When I first signed the book contract with Doubleday, the contract said Life of Frank Sinatra, 352 pages. I did 3 years of research and interviewing and reading every single thing that had been written about Frank Sinatra before I set pen to paper. This it's a gigantic life and a gigantic career. It's a 60-year career, and I defy anybody to think of any entertainer, past or present, who could have a 60-year career. So, also, I think that when most people think about Frank Sinatra, they tend to think about the Sinatra of later years, either the portly later Sinatra, the guy with the less liberal politics and the bad toupee, or the late 50s, early 60s Sinatra, the King of Vegas, the ring-a-ding-ding, head of the Rat Pack Sinatra. They don't think so much about the young Sinatra, the skinny Sinatra, Sinatra with hair, who was forming a career. And I felt as though this was a story people didn't really know much about. And in a gigantic life that touched on really every aspect of American culture and life in the 20th century, it seemed to me that Sinatra's own life divided into two parts, his early years when he was rising and less known at first, and then those later years that more of us know about and identify with him.
So as you researched him and learned a lot more about him, how did your opinion change of him as you worked on the book?
I was deeply impressed with how very hard he worked on his music. It sounds effortless. It wasn't. He was a great technician and labored mightily to achieve that effortless sound. I was also impressed by the complexity of his personality and the extent of his vulnerability. This is not to say that I forgave all his trespasses. You know, I say in the book that he was a genius. He also had a genius for making himself dislikable. His transgressions could be gigantic, could be awful. You know, he could be brutish. He could be thuggish. He had that inside him. He was an exceedingly complex man. But I always felt that that here was a genius who was able to be tender, who was able to who had enormous feeling for fellow human beings, who remained richly charitable for his entire life, often anonymously. He could be a devil. He could be an angel too.
Our guest today is James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice. James, thank you so much for being with us.
Stephen, it was a great pleasure talking with you.
So do you think that you'll follow up and write the second half of the book?
I think it is. The second book is a very different volume. I think it's a darker book. It's a tougher book. It deals with a lot of the things many people feel they know already about Sinatra. But I think that there's a real second story to be told there about the Sinatra of Vegas, Sinatra who was friends with the Kennedys, the ring-a-ding-ding Sinatra, and then beyond.
James, we will keep an eye out for that book. Once again, I'm Stephen Becker, and thank you for listening to Think on KERA.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.